There is a concern about packages emanating from Yemen.
The tip-off that led to the discovery of parcel bombs on two cargo planes last week apparently came from a former member of Al-Qaeda.
The source of the tip-off is an Al-Qaeda member based in Yemen who turned himself in to Saudi authorities 2 weeks ago. The man is a former Guantanamo Bay detainee who was returned to Saudi Arabia 4 years ago for rehabilitation, but later escaped to Yemen and rejoined Al-Qaeda.
Western intelligence concern about the ambition and growing capabilities of Al-Qaeda in Yemen has been rising for some time, and so has the focus of attention on the country.
Two planes, two explosive devices, and a security breach that has international terrorist experts in a tailspin. And according to American officials, the plot was hatched and the bombs were made in Yemen. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince. And today on Rear Vision, here on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and via the web, the story of modern Yemen. Yemen is situated on the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, at the intersection of the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. It's slightly smaller than France and borders Saudi Arabia and the Sultanate of Oman. Its mountainous interior is surrounded by narrow coastal plains to the west, south and east, and desert to the north along the border with Saudi Arabia. Yemen has always played an important role both in the region and in Islamic history. Paul Dresch is a lecturer in anthropology at the University of Oxford and the author of A History of Modern Yemen.
Everybody and anybody you can think of in early Islamic history was interested in Yemen. One movement after another tried to launch itself from Yemen with big ambitions. The Fatimids, who ended up as a great empire based on Cairo, their first intention had been to start off with Yemen, but it all went pear-shaped. And all sorts of sects, fairly obscure bits of Islam, the Ismailis and so forth, had a presence in Yemen. But the big things that run on into the present are the Zaydis, who dominated northern Yemen starting from about AD 900, and in one way or another, that ran down to the 1962 revolution. And then in lower Yemen, that's the bottom half of what used to be North Yemen, and in the coastal plains in the south, it was the Shafis. So you've got these two big blocks of Islamic tradition, if you like, which have been there for a very long time.
In the 19th century, Yemen was colonised by two major empires, the Ottomans in the north and the British in the south. Dr. Elham Mania is from Yemen and a senior researcher at the University of Zurich.
Britain had an interest in entering the region and being in Aden, not in Yemen as a whole, basically to secure its trade routes to India. The Ottoman Empire, on the other hand, when you look at the reasons, it has to do with securing the pilgrimage routes to Mecca, but at the same time, interestingly, North Yemen, it was colonized by the Ottoman Empire twice, one in the 17th century and one in the 19th century. The second time when they came to the region, they came actually by the request of some sheikhs in Yemen because of the decaying situation, a lawless region divided among competing imams, fighting tribal wars to an extent that people felt like we need a central authority. And then some of them invited the Ottoman, and the Ottoman complied, but unfortunately they would come to regret that decision.
Once both the Ottomans and the British were in the region, were they very different in terms of the way they exercised their power in the region?
Yes. Britain, for instance, and this is another factor that one has to mention, that south of Arabia or south of Yemen was divided into two parts. One is Aden, the port, which was very important for Britain. And then you had also 24 emirates, sultanates and sheikhdoms, which for Britain was merely a buffer zone to Aden. On the one hand, Aden, Britain basically invested in the infrastructure, turned it into a bustling economic zone. On the other hand, the 24 sultanates and emirates, she was satisfied in signing treaties that gave her the right to control the foreign policies of these units, but leaving the social order to these units. On the other hand, when you look at the Ottoman Empire, the way it ruled in Yemen, North Yemen, it seems from historical books that the Ottoman Empire was more interested in collecting taxes. It used very brutal methods in enforcing its own of rule, and it was no surprise that the tribes simply revolted.
By the early part of the 20th century, there was significant resistance to Ottoman rule in North Yemen.
You'd had a movement of resistance led by Zaydi Imams. Now, Imams were meant to be men both of the book and of the sword, great scholars but also war leaders. And one of them, Imam Yahya, had pretty much fought the Ottomans to a standstill in 1904, 1908. 1911 there's a truce signed between him and the Ottomans, sort of recognizing his suzerainty or everyday control over the northern parts of North Yemen. When the Ottomans collapse in 1918 and are obliged to withdraw as part of the end of the First World War, Imam Yahya moves southward and fills the gap. He took over a few ideas from the Ottomans. Although the Ottomans hadn't made a great change, they had introduced the electric telegraph. That was a useful thing for a ruler. And, of course, the idea of a regular army. And in a rather ramshackle way, Imam Yahya set up a regular army. He set up a rudimentary civil service. He began to set up little schools to train bureaucrats and telegraphists and this kind of thing. So there was an idea of statecraft which was passed on, but it wasn't very powerful or well organized.
North Yemen was very isolated. One of my aunts was telling me that the first time she listened to radio, she thought a genie was in that radio talking to her. This gives you basically the kind of isolation this region was living in. Books used to be smuggled into the country because it wasn't allowed to enter the country.
Well, a lot of the Shafis in the area south of Sana'a, they accepted Imam Yahya as ruler of much of Yemen. On the whole, people accepted Imam Yahya as a legitimate ruler. You then get opposition from younger people who are reading more widely, they're travelling a little bit, and they're thinking, well, hang on, this is a terribly backward sort of state we've got, we should be doing better. But it's really a rival family looking for the imamate who leads the rising against Imam Yahya. They actually assassinate him in 1948. His son Ahmed took over and suppressed the rebels in a pretty brutal way. And Ahmed, one way or the other, tottered on until his death in 1962. His son, Mohammed al-Badr, took over and only lasted a couple of weeks. By then, there was a plot among the army, such as it was, and the Egyptians backed the plot and the civil war began.
The civil war in North Yemen began in 1962. It was a defining event for the region, involving both Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Well, it was a very big event indeed, and the civil war dragged on really until about 1968 or 70. It sputtered out gradually at the end. The Egyptians were very badly briefed on Yemen, and they thought they only had to turn up preaching Arab nationalism and modernity, and the place would be theirs. No idea at all what they were getting into. On the other side were the Saudis, who were not keen at all on the Egyptians moving into Arabia. And in a sense, you got a kind of proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Egypt, which went on down to 68 or so. How many people were killed in the process, nobody really knows, but a lot. And a lot of polarization, some tribes going with the Republicans, who were backed by Egypt, some going with the Royalists, who were backed by Saudi Arabia. At the end of it, they pretty much shook hands. I mean, people still know who was on which side, but there wasn't any great settling of scores. The government had been fairly crippled by the Egyptian presence. The Egyptians always wanted one of their own men running each office with a sort of Yemeni puppet in front of them, which the Yemenis didn't think much of. So by the end of the war, there's a rather weak administrative apparatus. Country's fairly much impoverished. No economic development really had taken place. Bit of urbanization and so forth, but really not in a very strong position as the war ends.
So what government or what influences then start to take hold in the north?
Once the Egyptians have gone and the civil war is declared over, rather nice scholarly old chap called Abdurrahman al-Riani was appointed president. He didn't last terribly long. He was booted out in 74. Really, he was just too nice, I suspect, and surrounded by squabbling factions and various other Arab governments with their fingers in the pie. So he was squeezed out in favour of a chap called Hamdi, who was an army officer. Hamdi lasts till 78. He was assassinated. Short period of a chap called Hashmi, again an army officer, and then 78, the present ruler, Ali Abdullah Saleh, he takes over, another army officer. So although the army looked from outside to be a bit of a joke, certainly not terribly efficient, that's actually where Yemen's leaders have come from for the last 40 years almost.
This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're taking a look at the history of modern Yemen. Unlike the Ottomans in the north, the British maintained control over most of South Yemen until 1967. During that time, Aden grew into a major international seaport.
South of Yemen, as I said before, Aden was a bustling port, bustling economic center, and economic prosperity also led to the creation of a middle class, and this middle class created newspapers, political parties, unions. Aden was also a center of ideas. But nevertheless, please don't forget the fact that I'm talking about Aden, the port, but I'm not talking about the hinterland, which comprise the whole of south of Arabia. Aden is only a port. The 24 sultanates, sheikhdoms and emirates, they were also living in their own isolation in one way or another, or at least they were living in a certain social order that wasn't exactly a very progressive.
Well, in the south, you've got the growth of Aden Port, and it gets to be very big. By the 60s, you're looking at well over 200,000 people, which by Arabian standards was a really, really major settlement. The old Adeni families were not very numerous and didn't really control things. A lot of workers had come in from North Yemen, and quite a large Indian population. Now, in South Yemen, the British had not transformed South Yemen, but they had, in the usual way of empires, unwittingly produced their own downfall. They had produced a small bureaucratic class of clerks and school teachers and so forth, who themselves got nationalistic ideas and wanted the British out. The two revolutions came together. The one in the north in 1962 very much excited people in the south. Some of the people in the south, of course, were themselves northerners. And the two things ran rather in parallel through the 60s. A lot of to-ing and fro-ing, a lot of political complications. But a real sense through most of the period of Yemeni nationalism.
Britain wanted to pave the way for its withdrawal from south of Arabia. It was afraid to do that, leaving this region divided along all these different lines. So it came up in the late 50s with the idea that let's unify these divided units. And at the beginning, it didn't want to include Aden because the Adenis, they didn't want any unification with the hinterland because they considered them ethnically different and backward. So the first attempt to unify these units, it didn't work. Then Britain came with a second idea in 1962, and that is the Federation of United Arab States. And here it included Aden. At the same time, you had two kind of movements fighting for independence. One which had very strong relationship with Egypt Nasser, and the second was an independent front which used violent struggle in order to reach to independence. Britain, eager to leave the region, in the end did not want to make peace or to give the region to this front which had strong relationship with Egypt. Instead, it gave it to the front, which claimed to be independent of Egypt, but turned after independence into communism. And that more or less, once independence came 1967, this decision to give the authority to the one which was independent of Egypt actually shaped the history of the region for the next decades.
Paul Dresch argues that Britain never really decided what to do with Aden.
If you think back, that whole illusion of Britain as an imperial power goes on very, very late. It goes right on down through Harold Wilson and so forth, east of Suez and all that. So Aden was a prestige item and some sort of base, but they could never figure out a strategy. And they never figured out what to do with Adeni politics either. So it's a great big muddle. The fighting in the south against the Brits and one faction against another gets worse and worse from 62, 63 through to the end of 67. Towards the end, one of the local factions or organisations, the NLF, takes over, beats Flossy. And when the Brits finally leave in a flurry, the NLF seize power. And then you get an increasingly radical sounding government in the south under a succession of presidents with episodes of collectivization, land appropriation, all sorts of exciting things.
You have to look at this within the context also of the Cold War. South of Yemen allied itself with the Soviet Union. It allied itself with Eastern Germany, with Cuba, and more or less tried to export this ideology in the region. At the same time, North Yemen, which had its own development, became more or less a satellite state of Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia was allied with the United States in this Cold War. As a result, the two Yemens became more or less a front of this Cold War. Saudi Arabia and Yemen, in trying to compact the socialist ideology of south of Yemen, they started to spread the religious ideology of Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabism, into the North Yemen. And then at the same time, spreading in the whole country. I mean, you have in the 70s a curriculum that more or less taught 1 hour of religious class that turned into 7 or 8 hours per week, basically on religion. But it's not any religious interpretation of Islam. It was the Wahhabi interpretation of Islam exported from Saudi Arabia. It was a way of confronting socialism, but the consequences, we see it today.
After South Yemen gained its independence from the British, there were discussions between the two Yemens about unification, but they came to nothing. Then, in the late 1980s, the Soviet Union collapsed, and South Yemen lost its main ally.
South of Yemen was facing the fact that the Soviet Union was more or less focused on its own reform. It wasn't about to support other satellite states like south of Yemen anymore. So the Soviet Union used to give it annually $400 million as a direct support for its budget, and it ended up with only $50 million. At the same time, there were some oil fields that were discovered between the borders between North and South Yemen. The issue was basically to whom belonged these fields, and these were huge fields, in light of the fact that there was no demarcation of borders between North and South of Yemen. When both countries gave different concessions to different countries, the two countries were about to enter into another third war between North and South of Yemen. The sudden collapse of the Soviet Union and the desire of the leaderships of the two Yemen to actually make this unification possible, all these factors combined together made it possible that they actually said, let's talk about unification between North and South of Yemen.
I think it happened rather suddenly. I was actually at a conference in London when this happened. And the whole room was full of people who'd spent a lifetime studying Yemen. Nobody was expecting it, and it caught out absolutely everybody. There'd been a lot of pious noises made about unification for decades, but nobody really expected it to happen that easily. I think probably the South realized, or the South leaders realized, they just couldn't carry on. The Soviet bloc had collapsed, their funding, their military support had evaporated, Berlin Wall had come down. And I think they probably reckoned if they carried on their own, they'd end up like Ceausescu or somebody. That may be a little cynical, but I suspect that's what the calculation was. Either we unify or we're finished.
The Republic of Yemen was declared on the 22nd of May, 1990. Its first constitution committed Yemen to free elections, a multi-party political system, equality under the law, and basic human rights.
Well, there'd been a lot of elections in the north, not for national government, but for a thing called the General Popular Congress, which is now the ruling party. In the south, there'd been regional elections of one kind or another, so people were used to the idea of elections. Multi-party stuff was rather adventurous. I mean, this is not something that's very common in the Arab world. People were very interested, some distrust, some fear of disorder, but there was a burgeoning of small political parties, newspapers of various kinds. The early 90s were a very, very exciting period. Behind it, however, was this balance of power between Sana'a and Aden, between the erstwhile government of the north and the erstwhile government of the south, and neither party trusted the other, and they never really worked hard to make it work.
It was a time of hope, and many people actually believed that it would be possible to have this democracy. It would be possible for Yemen to implement these ideals that they inserted in their constitution. And I still remember that era because I lived through it. The hope that was in the air, the optimism the people were more or less reflecting, and the happiness that we are finally one country called Yemen, a regional power. But then Iraq invaded Kuwait, and Yemen, represented by its president Ali Abdullah Saleh, took a position which supported Iraq. And that was a fatal mistake, because that more or less paved the way for the deterioration of the whole situation in Yemen. That decision affected the economy of the country directly by the fact that Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, they sent back all the expats, the Yemeni labor workers who were working in Saudi Arabia and Gulf states. And this amounted to around 1 million workers. And they came back and they posed an economic burden on the country. At the same time, all this support, economic support, budget support coming from Kuwait, coming from Saudi Arabia, all of these stopped. The country was more or less besieged by its own, by the consequences of its own decision. At the same time, the northerners and the southerners' leadership within unified Yemen, they had differences. They had differences, cultural differences, and differences in style, where a confrontation had to happen because Ali Abdullah Saleh, he's been in power since 1978. He actually never believed in the rule of law. His was politics of survival, co-opting every religious or tribal leader in a manner that made it manageable to work with them, but they were never really acknowledging sovereignty of the state. These differences in the culture came to the fore, and in the end, both of them decided to go into this war of 1994. And the civil war ended that dream of having a unified Yemen ruled by democracy, ruled by the concept of human rights. It was the end of it.
The president of Yemen has called on his people to rebuild the country after 2 months of civil war. Secessionists in the south have been overrun by northern forces, and the southern capital of Aden has fallen.
Aden is the capital of the breakaway southern state, declared by southern leader Ali Salam al-Bayid, and its fall wipes out the last major southern stronghold. The northern leader, Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh, says the southern secession is over. The northern victory gives President Saleh a strong hand to reimpose unification on Yemen.
1994, when the dust settles, well, effectively you've still got the same northern sort of system, military-centred and some big merchants behind it. A lot of politics by patronage, small handouts here and there. Not a terribly efficient system of governments. No real impetus to administrative reform or anything terribly progressive.
This tribal military regime more or less took it upon itself to appease extremism. And that is basically Salafiyas and Wahhabis, groups working in Yemen, because those actually were the one who helped Ali Abdullah Saleh to win the civil war in 1994.
According to an ancient Yemeni proverb, a foreigner should always be well behaved. Perhaps a warning to be heeded today on the streets of the capital, Sana'a. Now a clandestine battlefield in Washington's declared war on terrorism.
Well, Yemen, as I said at the beginning, has this slightly mythic status. It's right there in Islamic tradition from the start as an ancient seat of civilization. It's very important in the rise of Islam. As part of that, all sorts of people, extremists and otherwise, had at one time or another passed through Yemen. So if you start making lists of suspect persons threatening this and that, you can be sure at some point these people will have passed through Yemen. Now, that doesn't mean there's some enormous social movement in Yemen itself, but it's a place everybody's been. So it was on the radar. Then, of course, Asala, his family originally are from South Yemen, and so on and so forth. And a lot of people involved in his apparatus were from Yemeni families, but had grown up in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. There were some rather alarming people in Yemen. You remember a bunch of tourists were shot, when was that, 98 in Abyan, I think. USS Cole got a big hole blown in it in Aden Harbor. So it was definitely on the radar screen. And I think after the attack on New York, there was a very real chance that the American military would take a crack at Yemen, that they would bomb camps around Abyan or something. That was avoided by Ali Abdullah, the president, pushed by various of his more clever advisers, to sign themselves up as allies of the Americans. And that's the position he's managed to hang on to since.
Whatever we are witnessing today in Yemen has to do with its history. This extremism that we are witnessing in Yemen, the fact that you have many who are more or less, or certain center, educational centers that produce extremists and fundamentalism, that has also to do with the fact that North Yemen was trying to fight this socialist ideology of south of Yemen with the help of Saudi Arabia. And for me, it's when I tell this story, it's a sad story. It breaks my heart because I lived these years between 1989 and what follows this unification. I mean, these 3 years were very filled with hope.
It is a very poor country. Oil, I don't know what it's running at the moment, 300,000 barrels a day, something like that. Not a lot, not enough to do anything very useful with. A pretty dysfunctional government. Population has shot up. Population's increasing at something like 3.4% per annum. I mean, absolutely huge figures. So an awful lot of people. The economy is completely bust, insofar as there ever was one. Again, to give you some idea, when I was first working in Yemen back in the 70s, there were 4.5 Yemeni rials to the US dollar, and it stayed that way for years and years. There are now about 200 to the US dollar. And in a country where you're having to import basic things like sugar and tea and, you know, everyday stuff, this hurts. So Yemen's now a poor country. New aid people make estimates that possibly a third of the population is in some degree malnourished. So it's very, very serious. In those circumstances, there are a lot of pretty unhappy people around. Until somehow or another we can help with a bit of economic development, actually get things working, it's going to be a difficult place. And the immediate prospects are not very cheerful.
Dr. Paul Dresch, author of A History of Modern Yemen, ending today's program. Our other guest was Dr. Elha Mania. She's a senior researcher at the University of Zurich. If you'd like to hear this program again, or to get a transcript of any other Rear Vision program, check out our website, abc.net.au/rn/Rear Vision. Today's sound engineer is Timothy Nicastri. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. Thanks for your company.